UCLA Üniversitesi'nde bir konuşma yapacağım.
I had to make a speech at the University of Los Angeles. It was addressed to the American diaspora over there. I began writing my speech with some words in Armenian, and I carried on writing. I understand your pain. I share your pain. I've come here to share your pain. And then I stopped for a moment and wondered, what suffering am I talking about? Go on, give it a name. And I thought, I'm talking about the suffering of genocide, am I not? I wrote the word genocide several times, then I crossed it out. Then I wrote it down again, then I crossed it out once more. Then I wondered why I, Hasan Cemal, have a problem with this word, genocide. I thought, why are you running away from this word? If it's what you think, write it down. What the Ottoman Armenians went through in 1915 and 1916 had been planned and systematically applied. That's genocide.
Constantinople, 1915. The Ottoman Empire was in decline and losing whole swathes of its territory. From this dying empire, a republic was born, one which targeted its ethnic and religious minorities. Two-thirds of the empire's Armenian population was wiped out. Though the denial in Turkey is still very powerful, recognition of the genocide is starting to be put on the table. One century later, voices are finally calling for the veil to be raised on this troubled period of history. As is Hasan Cemal, grandson of one of the main architects of the genocide.
Cemal Pasha was my grandfather. He was one of the three leaders of the Committee for Union and Progress, this organization which played an important part in the ruin of the Ottoman Empire. When we talked about him, we'd call him Papi Pasha, and we're very proud of him, of course. We're now in Haydar Pasha station. When we talk about Haydar Pasha, it is, of course, a place with great symbolic value because of the events of April the 24th, 1915, the Armenian genocide. Just before the genocide, they wanted to silence the Armenian intellectuals. For the intellectuals, the writers, and the artists are the blood vessels of society.
Haydar Pasha Station. It was here on the Asian shore of the Bosphorus that the first deportees of the first genocide of the 20th century left. It was April 24th, 1915, a time when Istanbul was called Constantinople.
That date was quickly considered as the founding act of the mass violence. Quite simply because that day, the Ottoman authorities had decided to arrest the entire Armenian elite. That included not only the political class, the MPs in the Ottoman parliament, but also the leading lawyers, businessmen, renowned journalists, writers. The entire elite was arrested and deported and would be executed in isolated spots during the weeks that followed.
On April 24th, 1915, there was a roundup, rather like the Veldiv, but different, because this was a highly targeted roundup, limited to around 2,500 intellectuals, the leaders of the Armenian community. And that's why we take that date as the beginning of the genocide.
Circular 3052, dated April the 24th, 1915, and signed by the Minister of the Interior, Talat Pasha, ordered the military authorities and administrations of the entire Ottoman Empire to arrest the local Armenian elite. We can call this the official launch of operations.
Behind this decision was a trio of officers of the Ottoman army who were called the Young Turks. Talat, Enver, and Cemal Pasha formed the triumvirate who planned the Armenian genocide.
I, Hasan Cemal, grandson of Cemal Pasha, as such, was becoming a focus for interest. In fact, as a journalist, when I had to make an appointment with a statesman, for example, the fact that I was grandson of Cemal, particularly in the first years of my professional life, was of great use to me. I can't deny that. When I look at this photo, I see both the greater history and that of my family, but I've drawn a line between the two. When we talk of history, this trio is still called Enver, Talat, and Cemal, my grandfather. These were the three leaders of union and progress. It was they who seized power and imposed a dictatorship in the latter period of the Ottoman Empire.
At its height, the Ottoman Empire stretched over three continents. But by the end of the 19th century, it was shrinking fast. 80% of its territories in Europe had been lost. The minorities on the margins of the empire went to war against the power of Constantinople. They demanded their independence and obtained the backing of Western democracies.
In the patchwork kingdoms of the Balkans, the old army game was never interrupted by the passing of the centuries. King Ferdinand of Bulgaria was called the Fox of the Balkans.
Nationalist ideology was seducing the Ottoman elite, just as the empire suffered successive defeats. Prelude to a bitter rout in the Balkans in 1912. It was against this backdrop that the Young Turks overthrew the Sultan and seized power, creating the Committee of Union and Progress. They soon ruled unchallenged, became more radical, and imposed forced assimilation on the various peoples who made up what was left of the empire.
We went from an imperial, multi-ethnic, multicultural system to a nation-state system. The firm intention of the Committee for Union and Progress, the Young Turks, was to turn the Ottoman Empire into a Turkish state.
The world was changing around the empire, and these changes would have consequences on community relations and on the status of each individual. The leaders of the Young Turks movement went from a more political, legalistic, intellectual mindset to one that was materialistic and far more violent, far more nationalistic.
Settled for more than 3,000 years on these strategic plateaux, at the crossroads of empires, trade routes, and invasions, the Armenians lived in these lands of eastern Anatolia in perfect harmony with the other peoples of the Ottoman Empire. At the start of the 4th century after Jesus Christ, the Kingdom of Armenia was the first state to adopt Christianity as its official religion. 16 centuries later, having preserved their cultural and religious identity, the Armenians were denounced by the Muslims. Victims of the rising nationalism and pan-Turkism, they then became enemies of the interior. The place of Armenians within the empire was under threat. Lawyer, civil rights activist Fethiye Çetin was a former political prisoner very involved in civil society. At the end of her life, her grandmother told her of her secret origins. She revealed that she was Armenian, a survivor of the genocide of 1915. A shock for Fethiye, who always believed she was Turkish. Today she is fighting for the rehabilitation of the Armenian memory and for another type of citizenship in Turkey.
she revisits her past in the village where her grandmother was born.
These fountains are Armenian architecture. They're called compartment fountains. They're used like a wash house. These are village fountains, and my maternal grandmother's house stood not far from here. In her childhood, my grandmother would come to draw water from this fountain. Her mother washed her clothes here, her kilims. Up until the age of 9, my grandmother lived in this village. She was the eldest daughter of the Gadaryan family. This village had 2 churches and 2 schools. My grandmother was educated in one of them. She had very pleasant memories of her life here. Obviously, until she was 9, she had a very happy childhood.
The Ottoman Empire was a multinational, multiracial, multi-ethnic empire, and the Armenians occupied a very important place. Demographically, as they were present practically all over the empire, to the east and to the west, in the capital, of course, and actually to the east more than the west, as the 6 provinces that they called the eastern provinces were mainly Armenian. So it was a population with deep roots, one that was here well before the Turks, in fact. A local native people who adapted easily to the Ottoman presence. The integration of Armenians and the presence of Armenians are played out on 2 levels. There's a first upper level, if you like, which is the integration from the top, by the civil service, by the administration, and by the state. And then you can't really distinguish the mass of the Armenian population from the mass of the Muslim population, as they're essentially made up of peasants, farmers, and craftsmen, both in cities and provincial towns. The profile of the Armenian population looked extremely like the profile of the Muslim population. The Ottoman Empire was defined very hierarchically by a sort of division of the population into Muslims and non-Muslims. The Muslims were superior. It is they who matter. The non-Muslims, though free to practice their faith, were not on an equal footing. The Armenians had always been treated as, let's say, second-class subjects. And this mixture was becoming more and more explosive. On the one hand, a non-Muslim population, who are oppressed because they can't express their national identity, and on the other, a Muslim population embittered by the defeats on the Russian front and the European front. And that, in a way, was the start of the Armenian question.
War was the key condition for the Young Turks to implement genocide against the Armenian people.
1914 and the outbreak of the First World War. After a certain hesitation, the Ottoman Empire, already at war in the Balkans, committed to the Central Powers, Germany and Austria-Hungary, against the Entente, France, Britain, and Russia. Curbing Russian expansionism in the Caucasus became an absolute imperative. Trapped by the winter, the Ottoman army suffered a stinging defeat in Sarıkamış. In January 1915, between 80,000 and 100,000 Ottoman soldiers on the Russian front died. It was a debacle. On the way home, the soldiers took revenge on the Armenian population. Yet the Armenians were well integrated in the Ottoman army, but the fact that a handful of them had rallied to the Tsar's army was used as a pretext to accuse the entire Armenian community of treason. The Armenian conscripts were disarmed. Several weeks later, they were all executed. It is April 18, 1915. In the Van region, historical cradle of Armenia, 60,000 Armenians were massacred. The survivors fell back to Van, where they offered resistance and tried to save the town while waiting for the Tsar's troops to liberate them. Called an insurrection, the self-defense of Van was yet another pretext to displace Armenians throughout the empire. In the six Armenian provinces, the scenario was similar. Men were massacred where they stood. Women and children were deported.
My grandmother, who was a child of the Gadarian family, told me that the year of her ninth birthday, one fine day, the gendarmes raided the village. First of all, they rounded up all the men in the village, then the women and children, and they took them all to Palu. All along the way, the women and children had to walk. Everyone was on foot. This is Palu. In days gone by, this was a very big town, but now there's nothing left. Only these ruins. Palu was the commercial hub of the region. In Armenian, its name is Palovnit. It's a place that historically was very symbolic, both for the region and for the Armenians. But unfortunately today, Palu has been erased from the map. They took people down by this path to the church further down and piled up the women and children in the church courtyard. Then heart-rending cries were heard coming from outside the yard. To see where the crying was coming from and what was happening outside, young girls climbed on the shoulders of the bigger ones. Then they cried out, and my grandmother heard, "They're slitting the men's throats and throwing them in the river." The people here told exactly the same story. They were taken down this path, their throats were slit, and they were tossed in the river. There were so many corpses that the pillars of the bridge were blocked by bodies piling up. They slit the throats of so many people here that the waters of this river ran red for days and days. Then my grandmother, her brothers and sisters, and all the survivors of these events were forced to undertake the famous Walk of Death. They were made to climb the mountains around Palu. They walked for days and days, weeks, thirsty and hungry. They went past the town of Elazığ and arrived in Maden. There, where the Tigris is deep, my grandmother's aunt drowned herself and her two children in the river. My grandmother kept telling the story because she was dreadfully shocked by what she had seen. One of the children, who had been thrown in the water, poked his head above the water, and the aunt hurried over and pushed it back down. But the child stuck out his head again, and again the aunt pushed his head underwater and held it there. My grandmother was totally shattered. Thank you.
From the end of May, they witnessed the deportation of women and children, in other words, people without defense. We have listed 317 convoys of deportees, with an extreme concentration in the months of June, July, August, during which more than 1 million people were displaced towards the deserts of Syria and Mesopotamia. The police drew up the list of deportees by name, by family, with the name of the head of the family even when he was no longer there. Then it was by neighborhood, according to size. The number of deportees in the convoys varied between 1,500 and 5,000. Initially, they were permitted to rent carts. Basically, they used these carts to stow equipment and so on. Because officially it was termed a displacement for safety reasons. These carts, after 100 or 150 kilometers, the carters who were chartered left the deportees where they were and returned home. And then the long journey, what they called the walk of death, began. Several hundred kilometers, sometimes 1,000 kilometers, to reach the Syrian desert. These deportees had possessions with them when they set out. Some of them hid them where they were. That's the obsession with Armenian treasure that still endures to this day in Turkey. Others, for example, sewed gold coins into the lining of their jackets. All sorts of techniques were used because they were aware that they were going to be looted on the way. And they were looted, and when there was nothing left, only individuals, then the individuals themselves became merchandise. And you arrived at a situation where the local rural population had virtually nothing left to loot. So what did they do? They took away the best-looking girls, they took away the children, and in certain towns, the young women were sold for less than a gold coin.
The walks of death saw the entire Armenian population of Anatolia deported. All along the way, massacres, looting, rapes, and child abduction was the daily fare of Armenians. Exhaustion and sanitary conditions saw off the weakest amongst them. Between 1 million and 1.5 million Armenians were exterminated between April 1915 and December 1916. Ago, Fethiye Çetin wrote a book that recounted the saga of her grandmother, a book that jogged the memory of Mehmet. Their grandparents were from the same village and were in the same convoy. For the first time, Fethiye is meeting Mehmet in Çermik, an important stage in her grandmother's life.
Later, when they arrived in Çermik, the Muslim families wanted to adopt children. My grandmother's mother didn't want to give away her child, her precious daughter. But the whole group retorted, "We're all going to die. At least leave your child so she'll survive."
These are terrible stories. Very trying indeed.
My grandmother said that once they'd arrived at Hamambashi, some Muslim families adopted children.
My grandfather was adopted too.
There was no camp.
They passed in convoys.
They made them walk as far as there. They were on foot. There was no stopping on the way. They arrived in a pitiful state. They were exhausted.
Like those who are fleeing from the Islamic State at the moment.
Exactly. When they left in groups for Syria, all along the way, they confiscated their children. They're young daughters.
First the best looking, then the children. What happened here?
Things happened here. During the events of 1915, according to what my grandfather said, they brought the Armenian men here in their military trucks, telling them they were going to kick them out of the country. Then they threw them in there.
All the men here?
Yes. They threw off all the men. That's what's handed down through the generations. Soon afterwards, they said to the women and children, go and get ready. We're taking you to see your men. Get dressed up, put on your makeup and jewelry. And when they arrived here, they confiscated all their jewels, and then they threw them in this chasm. Some women saw what was happening, and they stood up, head held high in sign of dignity, and they threw themselves into the void. This is a place where all traces of history and humanity got lost.
There are so many precipices called Armenian precipice. There are so many rivers where they threw people after slitting their throat. There are so many examples like those people whose heads were crushed by stones. What we must do now is face this extraordinary, inhuman savagery.
Au total, sur l'ensemble du territoire.
In all, over all the territory, there were 32 slaughterhouse sites, which made use of the tormented geography of Asia Minor. The gorges, for example, the gorges which form the upper Euphrates in the region of Kema to Erzincan, where squadrons of Teshkila Tumashusha moved in and managed the deportees which passed that way, by looting them, of course, and by liquidating the last adult men who were there, and by sending these deportees even further south. The statistics at our disposal allow us to state that only 15 to 20 of these deportees made it to the deserts of Syria and Mesopotamia. The final stage took place between the month of July and the month of December 1916. 192,750 Armenians, according to the official Ottoman statistics, were at that time present in Zor, in Der Zor, and they were executed in packets of 3,000 to 5,000 in the regions close to the Syrian and Mesopotamian deserts.
And it happened in a programmed way. Whether or not you accept the word genocide, you're forced to admit one thing, that it was an infamy. You can call it what you want. Slaughter, ethnic cleansing, population transfer, deportation. But you're forced to admit that this was something horrible, infinitely cruel. And it was planned.
My grandmother also taught me this expression, remains of the sword. That's what they call the survivors of the genocide, like my grandmother. The first time I heard that term, that expression, I was petrified. You put thousands of people to the sword, and the few that survive, you call them the remains of the sword. Not just my grandmother, of course, all the survivors.
Not all the remains of the sword, the survivors of genocide, were adopted and forced into Islam. Several hundred thousand orphans found themselves stateless and were taken in by the victorious Allied troops. They left for the West, bound for France, the United States, Canada,
where they would form a people in diaspora. A survivor of hell, Aurora Mardiganian, was 16 when she arrived in the United States. She wrote an account of her ordeal. In 1919, Hollywood adapted it for the silver screen. This film perfectly retraced the various stages of the Armenian genocide. The arrests, the execution of the men, the deportation of the women and children, the looting, the rapes, the death. The end of the First World War tolled the knell for the Ottoman Empire and the fall of the Young Turks regime. Enver, Cemal, and Talat Pasha fled the country for Germany. Sentenced to death in absentia for organizing deportations and mass crimes, all three ended up assassinated. In Turkey, they turned the page. They forgot. They looked toward the future. The man they needed was former army officer Mustafa Kemal. He even baptized himself Ataturk, the patriarch of the Turks, the strongman of the brand new Turkey. A secular society which was quick to give women the vote, to westernize, at least in appearance. Ataturk restored the Turks' pride and confidence, a dream situation for rewriting Ottoman history, forgetting the Armenian ghost.
The Republic of Turkey is built upon a genocide because the Republic was created by the Young Turks and is its logical continuation. We don't just see that in the organization of the state, but we also see it in its own laws, the same ones as before. It was the overall system that was a continuation of the genocide, a consequence of the Young Turks, and that's what I began to understand.
History doesn't yet belong to the past. It is still relevant. Until very recently, it was very dangerous to go anywhere near history. It was a political problem.
At school, they told us nothing about history. None of our friends or family discussed it, certainly not out loud. We had no information on the subject. On the contrary, we were told glorious stories about our past, nationalistic, Turkophile, racist, chauvinistic stories. Because of all that, I was very surprised at first. But then, thinking about it, I realized that what my grandmother had told me was absolutely true.
We only knew of the existence of 1915 as part and parcel of the official history. My mind was also taken hostage by the red lines of the official history. But as soon as I could break those chains, I became free. Free to think for myself.
For a while, the authorities ignored it, pretended the genocide had never existed. And afterwards, when they had to talk about it, they began by accusing the Armenians. Armenians are traitors. They stab us in the back. That's just why we found ourselves with no choice but to deport them. They're bad. They're dangerous.
Practically three generations were born either in denial or in total ignorance. And after three generations, four generations even, it is very difficult to make people understand that, yes, 100 years ago this happened or that happened. Whereas the education system, the media, everything has contributed to forgetting all about it. Le déni. Turkish denial, or Turkish ignorance, has been fairly easy to establish, as it only amounted to shutting the closet door with all the skeletons inside. In other words, to not talk about it. It's a memory that has been manipulated, which itself has faded. Especially as Turkish nationalism was, like all nationalisms, but perhaps more than others, based on paranoia and conspiracy theories. It is very easy to convince a Turkish citizen that the Armenian demands are just a manipulation of the forces of evil, etc., of the Westerners. It works very well.
The evidence is in Igdish, where a Holocaust denier museum was erected in 1997. Its rewriting of history is breathtaking. One of its initiators is Guksel Gulbey, president of the International Association to Fight Baseless Armenian Allegations.
Here we are in a museum and a memorial erected to the memory of those Turks who were massacred by armed gangs of Armenians during the First World War. This is the highest monument in Turkey. Here we exhibit photos of the massacres which took place in various regions. There's also a genocide memorial in Armenia. And we thought, they're putting up a memorial for this so-called genocide when it was we who were massacred? Why shouldn't we do the same thing? We're within our rights. Why let injustice pass? So we designed this museum as a riposte. We are fighting these theories defended by the Armenian diaspora and directed against Turkey and the Turks. What do these theories say? That we, the Turks, during a population transfer in 1915, massacred them. They claim that on April 24th, we began a genocide against them. What I say to them is, was there a deportation on April 24th? No, sir. Was there a massacre? No, sir.
A genocide is a new word combining the Greek word genos, genos meaning race or group, with the root of the Latin sedere meaning to kill. Dr. Raphael Lemkin, who is a professor of law at Yale University and specializing in teaching matters about the United Nations. Dr. Lemkin is the man who created the word genocide. Dr. Lemkin, could you give us a little background on how you came to be interested in this genocide?
I became interested in genocide because it happened so many times. It happened to the Armenians, and after the Armenians, Hitler took action.
The term genocide dates from the Second World War. Lemkin, to firm up the word and the concept, drew his main inspiration from the Armenian example. Lemkin had been alerted as a young law student in Lvov, in Poland, by the trial of the murderer of one of the main culprits of the genocide, Mehmet Talat. This trial was held in Berlin. What we heard about during the trial wasn't the murder of Talat, but all the crimes committed by the victim. It was virtually the trial of the victim.
My thoughts on 1915, on the Armenian genocide, were developed as part of a process. They didn't pop up fully formed overnight. I didn't think one morning, oh, that was genocide, or another infamous chapter of Ottoman history. In fact, it was a paradoxical process, which was open to many contradictions. Later, during the 1970s, there were attacks carried out by ASALA, the Armenian Liberation Army. I'd always considered their actions as those of vile terrorists, and still do. But at the same time, paradoxically, as violence, this terror committed by Asala, dragged the events of 1915 and the Armenian genocide to center stage. We didn't know what really happened in 1915, and we didn't know whether what was written in our history books was true or not.
Before the attacks of the Armenian terror group Asala, which targeted and assassinated Turkish officials, genocide wasn't evoked neither in the West nor in Turkey.
The skeleton closet had been reopened in the 60s by Asala. They allowed the Turkish state to point the finger at the terrorists, the anarchists, the murderers. What really opened the closet happened in the 80s, in the 90s, and was the opening up of Turkey itself to the outside world. We began to see and hear things, the things that were different from the monolithic discourse. Then came the intellectual effort. We have covered an extraordinary amount of ground. We're not there yet, but the taboo has crumbled.
When I spoke about it to my friends, I realized that everyone had a story to tell. Almost everyone had heard things about 1915 from their grandparents, but up until that day, we hadn't shared these stories between us. Then I was filled with a feeling of great shame. Firstly, because the other branch of my family was Turkish. I still carry that shame today. I live with it permanently. I feel it intensely, because we still haven't been able to come to terms with our history. And we're still bent under the weight of this denial.
Despite the slow evolution of Turkish society and a timid opening up of the powers that be, for the tens of thousands of descendants of Armenians living in Turkey, it is still very difficult to show or even admit to one's Armenianness. In Diyarbakir, several dozen of them have come together to restore their church. One of the leaders of the community fights daily for recognition. Gafur, like Fethiye Çetin, is a descendant of a genocide survivor, a remains of the sword.
In our family, we were not able to save our Armenian identity in the first generations because all the genocide survivors had to convert to Islam. They were forced into Islam. It was only much later that we could talk about our own identity. To Muslims, an Armenian is a gavur, an infidel dog, a dirty, rotten heathen. Consequently, the Armenians forced into Islam didn't talk about their roots. They hid them. They were ashamed and thought, what will my neighbor say if he finds out? So it was very difficult to live in society under an Armenian identity. It's still very complicated today. Being Armenian in Diyarbakir is still painful. And sometimes the Armenians in Europe and America, the diaspora, come here and criticize us because they don't understand our situation. They may have difficulties in Europe, but they can openly say that they are Armenian. Nobody bothers them, and they can practice their religion freely and speak their language if they like. Nobody is forcing them to convert to Islam, to become Muslim. In France, for example, that doesn't happen. And people don't insult them and call them heathens, whereas in Turkey, calling someone an Armenian is an insult.
Ermenilik küfürle anılır. Ve o çan kulesi yapılıyor 1914'te. Sonra soykırım.
This bell tower was built in 1914, but after the genocide in 1916, on the pretext that it was higher than the minarets on mosques, the army demolished it.
Top ateşiyle yıkıyorlar, bir hafta ancak yıkabiliyorlar.
To destroy it completely, they fired at it with a cannon. When we restored our church, we decided to rebuild the bell tower because it had gone one century without it. And today, in Diyarbakir, you can hear the bells ring. They now ring twice a day, and I'm very proud of that. It's a lovely bell tower.
Is it as tall as before?
No, we made it slightly smaller. You never know.
In 2007, the Turkish journalist of Armenian origin, Hrant Dink, was assassinated by a young Turkish nationalist. Founder of the newspaper Agos, Dink worked for reconciliation between Turkey and Armenia, so near yet so far, as he liked to repeat. Hasan Cemal was his friend, Fethiye Çetin his lawyer.
In Turkey, there is a before Hrant and an after Hrant. There's one thing people often mention, but I must repeat. More than 100,000 people attended his funeral in Istanbul. And the crowd walked along chanting, "We are all Armenian. We are all Hrant Dink." When he died in 2007... a repulsive assassination, I began to understand how my intelligence, my personal story, had been captured by the history of Turkey. And I really began to wonder.
When I started out as an activist and became interested in the rights of minorities, quite naturally, I met Hrant Dink. For as an important personality in the Armenian community, he was always in the foreground. When he was brought before the courts, he asked me to be his lawyer. At that time, Hrant really was an individual who stood out among all those Armenians who were all subdued, silent, and withdrawn. But he didn't shut up. He spoke out. Without any doubt, the murder of Hrant Dink broke something in this country. It's sad to say, and no one would have wanted this, but after his death, he's become more important than when he was alive.
When I went to Erevan in Armenia in September 2008, the most important event was my visit to the genocide memorial. I went through a great existential storm, but I also felt an inner peace because I had accomplished something that I had to do. I was more at peace with myself. I knew very well that I would be insulted by the nationalists in Turkey, that they'd call me a traitor to the motherland. I knew all that. But I did it anyway. The word genocide no longer constitutes a taboo. But the word genocide is still forbidden. To be more exact, you can still be arrested and prosecuted under Article 301. The book I wrote is very clear. Having called it 1915 Armenian Genocide, how could I say that my grandfather was a good man? Could you?
We restored these fountains with the farmers as part of a project that we began in 2009 and which ended in 2012. I was called and told, you know those fountains in your grandmother's village? Well, they're collapsing. And I was sent photos. And that's when the idea for this project hatched in my head and became a dream. I thought, let's repair these fountains all together, Turks, Kurds, and Armenians. And while we repair these fountains, let's remember our past. Through this project, let's all come to terms with our past and obtain reconciliation and become closer. Let's drink to the memory of the souls of those who suffered so much. Let's drink the same water together to the memory of all those who died.
Tekrar görüşürüz inşallah. Ona da çok selam söyle.